So we're bringing Umair online. Let me just kind of describe the setting to you. We're here in Northern Virginia. We have 20 students who are enrolled in this course in person here at George Mason. And then the rest of you who are, some of you dialing in at 5 a.m., some of you at 2 a.m. to join this class. I am going to be monitoring the Twitter feed. So if you're online, and so I've got a question. Who's the speaker? Okay, so that's a great question. So I'm Phil Auerswald. I am the lead instructor for this course. I'm a professor here at George Mason University. I'm the author of one of the three books that is assigned for you in this class, The Coming Prosperity, How Entrepreneurs Are Transforming the Global Economy. And I'm going to be joined, all right, well, Sandy Maxey is helping me out here, and I'm going to retweet what she just said. Better to start than to wait for perfect. Well, you know, it's true. We kind of got this, we got this idea 4 weeks ago. We found a great partner in Ashoka. My friend Aaron Krampitz from Ashoka U is here tonight, as well as Michael Youngblood, who's a co-instructor in this course, who's taken it in the past and has come back to be a mentor and a lead. We decided, you know, why don't we just try to get this rolling now? Let's just do it in the next 4 weeks. So we put it up, and in the last, you know, since then we've sort of been hacking the syllabus online, trying to find a collaborative workspace for you guys, experimenting with different platforms to do the call-in. We ended up with this one. We've already got one person saying, hey, you know, maybe it should have been Ustream. Anyhow, you know, there's all these technology choices, but the main thing for us is we're rolling. So now the thing that I want to be doing next, in fact, you know what, I'm wondering if I can't just patch Umair in from my phone. Okay, because worst case scenario, I'll just literally patch him in on my phone. What's that? Okay, well, so one of the things that doing this course this way has allowed us to do is to get some really fantastic speakers lined up. And Umair is a man of infinite patience and a good friend, and I'm really delighted that he's agreed to join us here for our first night. Umair is a blogger at Harvard Business Review. He has 180,000 or 90,000 followers on Twitter. He is the author of a number of books, most of which he published just recently in the last 2 years, The New Capitalist Manifesto and recently Betterness. And Umair is going to be talking about Betterness in particular tonight. That book, Betterness: Economics for Humans, is as I said, you know, particularly relevant to the theme of this evening's class, which is creating social value. As you know, in anticipation of tonight's session, we had a number of people sort of send in response to our email, you know, what they considered to be success for the course. And, you know, I'm, like, really appreciative of folks who've tweeted in saying, hey, we're online. Yep, good. And I also want to just be clear for the folks who are dialing in that what we've decided to do, you know, even low bandwidth apparently wasn't low bandwidth enough for tonight, but, you know, to start in as low bandwidth as we can. We don't have any visuals to go with it. There's no PowerPoint. There's no webinar. It's just dial in, just audio. So you're not missing anything if you don't have any visuals for tonight's event. You know, I can report to you firsthand that I'm not too much to look at, and you've got Umair's picture. He's a delightful guy, but okay, yeah. All right, Umair, are you there?
Yeah, can you guys hear me?
Oh, awesome. Okay, I think this is good. It's good.
Hey.
It's not perfect.
How are you?
It's not perfect, but it's good. Okay.
Okay,
all right, now,
cool.
In the room, can you guys hear anything? Are you guys on speakerphone? Put your speakers on. If you're here, we should be able to. I want to make sure the people in the room can hear you.
Yeah? How are you guys? Okay. How's everyone?
Here we go. All right. Yeah, well, I mean, I'm good now that this is rolling. This is like some kind of weird moon launch thing or, I don't know, something, Apollo 13 thing going on. That's probably going to be bad. That's going to freak me out. Umair, we're talking about creating social value tonight. There's some folks, we're only 13 minutes in. That's pretty good. So we're going to do 5 minutes of kind of background and intro. Welcome to the course. I'm going to reiterate my welcome. And I'm going to, express my real excitement that you're here. Aaron, could you check around the room and see if anybody can hear Umair? Sounds good? Okay. And then I want to transition right into this conversation that you and I had planned for this evening. The title of this session is Creating Social Value. And, when I look at the responses that people tweeted in about, what they wanted to get out of this course, a lot of them had to do with, creating value for themselves and for society. I think that, we didn't have a single person, and I think that actually this would have been fine, but it was an open-ended question. It's a course on entrepreneurship and globalization. And, nobody mentioned buying their first or second Bentley. So I think that people are coming to this experience with a sense of they want to get something out of it that isn't just about financial gain, financial profit. So how do you think about betterness? Michael, put me on the speakers up here. I'm going to go from out there so that everybody can hear. So how do you think about betterness and creating social value, Umair?
So listen, I think it's a fantastic question, and it's an interesting question because one of the kind of central notions in econ, one of the kind of great hinges that binds the whole body of thought together is the idea of social value. But when you delve into it, we don't have a great definition of it. So let me talk a little bit about what it's not, and then some approaches for thinking about what it might be. So what is social value not? Sometimes when we talk about social value, which is becoming a bit of a more and more frequent topic of conversation these days, I think sometimes when we talk about it, we discuss it under the conceit that social value is somehow value that only accrues to this mysterious entity known as society. Society is made up of people. I think that for us to take any notion of value seriously, it has to be value that, in some sense, accrues to people and results in real tangible benefits in their lives. So social value, I think, in the simplest analysis, is not some kind of nebulous idea of value that's accruing to various kinds of institutions, whether they're governments or different actors within this kind of matrix of the state or what have you. It's really about people. And so that brings me to a point about what social value, one way to think about what social value is. So let's go back to one of the simplest notions of econ. It's kind of the gains from trade. If you have a transaction, I buy something from you, you exchange something with me, one of us gets the money. Now, the money, we know how to measure and monitor and think about and track. But the other stuff, the stuff that I'm supposed to get as a result, we're much less good at figuring out how to really conceptualize it and see it and bring it to life. And I think that is really the stuff of social value, if that makes sense. Are you with me so far? Hello, did I cut out?
No, I'm here. I'm here with you, Umair. One of the examples that I love to bring up, as far as social entrepreneurship is concerned, is the example of Ayurveda eye hospitals. And yeah. So I don't know if you recall that particular one, I'm wondering, this notion of different modes of social value and how in particular an entrepreneur can think about dimensions of success in an entrepreneurial venture, given what you've just said.
So let me get a little bit technical for a second. So one of the things I think is really important to do in any discussion of social value is to really begin thinking about it a little more rigorously than maybe we have been, encouraged to do over the last few years. And so let's distinguish a couple of basic economic concepts, right? Flows and stocks. So a flow measure is about incomes, right? What's coming in at any given moment in time? A stock measure is about how much has been accumulated over any period of time. And so one of the things that I think is really important to do when we're thinking about social value is first to distinguish between flows and stocks. And so what I propose in Betterness is that we take a kind of very comprehensive view of what stocks we are managing to accumulate as a result of some kind of endeavor or enterprise or transaction. So has this enterprise resulted in greater stocks of, for example, social capital? Or human capital in your eye hospitals, example. People that are attaining some greater level of human capital, basic human health and functioning. And so we can apply this kind of logic, this kind of capital-based thinking, across many different kinds of capital, right? So Richard Florida has proposed the idea of creative capital. We can think of different kinds of social enterprises that offer creative returns. But I think what's really important is to really kind of home in on the different kinds of capital that a given enterprise or endeavor can generate, and then begin to think about, are we really able to create flows of these kinds of capital within a given set of actors? First, and second, are those flows able to accumulate into different stocks of capital? Because when we can transform those flows into stocks, then presumably we're really able to create wealth that endures and matters to people. Right? If we pioneered an enterprise like the eye hospital does, that really results in greater human capital being accumulated within a community, then we're on the verge of doing something really interesting and I think really disruptive.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that for modes of measures of profit and accounting success financially in a venture, that it's really a flow measure. It's basically how much of the flow do you capture. And that there's something about the process of creating social value that redirects towards the stock. And what do we think about the stock of human capital, the stock of natural capital, or the stock of trust? And that in that sense, a social entrepreneur or an entrepreneur focused on creating social value is a builder, not just only of material things, but a builder of the intangible stock of betterness in a society. Is that a way of describing what you're talking about?
Absolutely. I think that's a very elegant way to put it. I think that the role of a social entrepreneur, and I don't make a huge distinction between what we call social entrepreneurs today and what I think entrepreneurs are generally going to be thought of as going forward in the 21st century. I think that we're on the cusp of a kind of a redefinition of the ideas of wealth and value. And so I think that when we think about creating wealth and value, to some extent, the challenge of creating financial wealth and creating financial value is almost a solved problem, right? We have the tools and the frameworks to be able to do that. But what we're missing is the other side of the equation. So take my tiny example or your tiny example of an eye hospital being able to build up stocks of human capital within a community or a town. Well, that's really kind of saying this hospital may have to turn a profit. It may have to generate kind of financial income and financial wealth. But that financial income and financial wealth should also reflect the other side on that kind of gains from trade. That financial income and that financial wealth should also presumably reflect the creation of human capital and human wealth. And so let me put that to you in a slightly different way. One of the things that we were kind of encouraged to think about as kind of the dawn of the idea of social entrepreneurship is the idea of kind of a triple bottom line. And so one of the things that I've said in Betterness is, listen, the triple bottom line is a tiny example of beginning to update the ways that we think about value. And there's a much broader context here. So triple bottom line is just, you know, let's have a bottom line for people, planet, and profit. But what about thinking about the idea not just of a triple bottom line, but of a multidimensional bottom line for the many different kinds of capital? But that and that in itself, again, is only a flow statement. It's just an income statement. What if we have a balance sheet for many different kinds of capital? Then we're beginning to really track and measure the different kinds of wealth that we're able to build and create for society. And to me, that's kind of the heart of the idea of social value.
So now, Amir, let's redirect for a moment. I think we've got some, a few operational principles for aspiring entrepreneurs, to think about what stocks it is in society of health, of wellness, of connectedness, of natural resources, that might be the focal point of a social venture. So we've got some kind of points of reference there. I want to just take a couple of minutes to talk about existing institutions, because certainly, you know, on your Twitter feed and elsewhere, you know, in your blog post, you're pretty critical of the 20th century institutions that have kind of percolated over into the 21st century. And so, what can you say about, you know, your assessment of how what institutions mean in this setting of creating social value and
sure.
role of entrepreneurs in changing whatever deficiencies
sure.
you might see?
Sure. So my criticism. So you hear a lot these days in the throes of this kind of never-ending financial crisis about, you know, our institutions have failed. And what this line tends to mean, and it's coming a lot these days from kind of journalists and analysts and all kinds of people, and what this line tends to mean, if you translate it, is something like our banks aren't doing the job they were supposed to do. And that's not what I mean by our institutions have failed. Yes, our banks didn't do the job they were supposed to do, but that's a very tiny example of a much bigger problem. And the bigger problem is this. Because we don't measure these kinds of capital that I've been talking about, and that we've been discussing here, they're kind of invisible from our economy. And so what's happened is that we don't really have, you know, institutions create incentives for people. And we don't really have the incentives for people to go in and create them. And so we've been left with this very lopsided economy where the guys that shuffle the wealth, the guys that kind of allocate the wealth, are being rewarded disproportionately. They're being rewarded orders of magnitude more than the guys that build and create the wealth. And so we have an economy that is institutionally biased away from builders and makers and creators and doers and dreamers, and institutionally biased towards, you know, the shufflers and the allocators. And this is a tremendous, tremendous problem. Because it leaves us with kind of a shortage of these big ideas and innovations on the ground. You know, Tyler Cowen, of course, has talked about the Great Stagnation. Many people are beginning to pick up where he left off. But I think the central thesis that I raise when I say we live in an era of institutional failure is that our institutions bias us away from the builders and the creators of real value, human value, social value. They disincentivize us to do stuff that matters, that lasts, that endures, that multiplies. And instead, they incentivize us to kind of take on these very trivial things, right? And we have some great examples recently. We have IPOs for companies that arguably create very little human value, and whose stock is now kind of cratering as people clue into the fact that this may not be the most productive way, not just to run an economy, but to run a business.
So Now, what you're you know, describing here in terms of the shuffling or reallocation of wealth rather than the creation of wealth and prosperity, you know, critically, sounds a lot to me what we in economics talk about rent seeking, you know, talk about as rent seeking. And you know, I wanted to bring it back. I obviously we've known each other for a while. I know that your family is from Pakistan. You spent you know, quite a bit of time there. And one of the things that's particularly exciting about this course is we have folks participating from, you know, 40 countries around the world. And so, I mean, I think you have a perspective, you know, you spend a lot of time in the UK, you spend time in the US, you spend time in Pakistan, you go elsewhere. You know, how different is the environment for entrepreneurial initiative of the type that we're talking about in Pakistan versus the US? And how different or similar is the rent seeking that you see in a place like Pakistan as compared to, you know, what you see in the US?
Okay, so that's a fantastic question. You know, you're right. I have grown up all over the world, and I do spend a lot of time in Pakistan to go back and see various members of my family and stuff. And you know, in the last, I would say, 10 to 15 years, Pakistan has changed a lot. America has also changed a lot. And one of the things that really strikes me every time I go back to Pakistan, especially when I go back to America, is how similar the patterns of rent-seeking have become. And to be sure, you know, the patterns of rent-seeking are always pretty similar. But there are eerie and striking parallels that I see sometimes. You know, in a class of kind of elites in both countries, that is really able to use its political power to bestow upon itself economic privileges that go on to subvert the very ideas of kind of, you know, markets that are competitive in some basic sense. And so I think that in America we have to be very careful today. We see ourselves as a bastion of kind of capitalism and markets that work and in some sense are free. But I think what we've got today is an economic system that is a lot less capitalist than we think. And so to go to your second question, is where are, you know, the opportunities for entrepreneurs, especially in the developing world? Well, one of the things that I've been talking about here is the many different kinds of capitalists, and not just their kind of value in an instrumental sense, but the idea that if we are to be capitalists, to take the idea of capitalism seriously, then it's incumbent upon us to create enterprises and engage in endeavors that return those kinds of capital, that generate those kinds of wealth for people in society. And so this is where things get interesting, because one of the things that I've seen in Pakistan over the last 5 years that I really didn't expect to see is that it's becoming a little bit of a hotbed of social enterprise. And so there are different reasons to this, but to me the biggest reason is that where America is in a state of kind of institutional paralysis, Pakistan is kind of an institutional vacuum. And so there are all sorts of young people basically looking around.
Umair, I want to just pause there, because I think what you said is really great, and I hope somebody tweets it. You know, so I just want to repeat it. You're saying America is an institutional is in a state of institutional paralysis, but Pakistan's in a state of institutional vacuum. That's what you said?
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. So go ahead. Sorry, I wanted to keep you going. It just went by so quickly, I didn't want anyone to miss that.
Sure. And so I think the difference is that, so for a 20-something in the States, you see yourself at the mercy of these huge institutions, these lumbering that are kind of, you know, every step you take, your path is stonewalled and blocked. Whereas in Pakistan, institutions don't really exist. And so the 20-somethings and the young people, they may not have kind of a huge sense of optimism, but they do have a sense that they can take on enterprises and structure them in completely radical and novel and unanticipated and interesting ways. And so Pakistan, much to my surprise and much to my delight, is becoming something of a hotbed for social enterprise. There's social entrepreneurs trying to tackle all kinds of problems, from kind of healthcare to finance to clothing. And it's the kind of thing which I think took your kind of, you know, your Brooklyn hipster who's really getting into the idea of the social enterprise, and you took him back to Lahore for a few days. And you said, listen, look around and see what people are doing. They'd actually be very, very surprised to see this. And I think that's true in many parts of the developing world. We have huge institutional vacuums, pockets where institutions just haven't reached because they don't have the capacity or the reach or the power. I think the opportunity that creates, and to kind of square the circle and bring the discussion back to your real question, is that it creates the opportunity for entrepreneurs not just to think of themselves as business people anymore, but to think of themselves as builders of institutions that are going to last not just for a few years, but hopefully for a few decades. And they're going to help societies kind of bridge the gap of this huge institutional vacuum, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, I think that that's fantastic. Now, you know, what you're reminding me of, Omer, is I'll never forget a conversation I had with my friend Iqbal Qadir, who founded Innovations Journal. And, You know, it was really a lot through Iqbal's example that we started the journal about entrepreneurial solutions to global challenges. And Iqbal, was the founder of Grameen Phone. It was the first large-scale company to deliver mobile phone services in the, you know, so-called developing world. This is in Bangladesh, if I didn't mention that. But anyway, the conversation was with Iqbal and his co-founder with the global mobile or telecommunications company Telenor. So the person who'd worked with them to launch. And you know, so we were saying, you know, well, wasn't it hard to start a mobile phone company in Bangladesh? And you know, it must have been so challenging. And you know, they sort of looked at each other and said, you know, actually, it was easier than doing it in the United States because there was no regulatory structure. There was just all open playing field. And the only thing that they really needed to do was basically keep it under the radar of all of the incumbent economic and political interests that had so little belief that anything in mobile communications in Bangladesh in 1996 could ever be lucrative enough to pay attention to, that they were able to build very quickly. And that really stuck with me. So it sounds to me consistent with what you're talking about in terms of, you know, this contrast between institutional vacuums that exist in places that we think of, as being sort of in the state of paralysis, whereas in the alleged developed world, we're actually in the state of institutional paralysis.
Absolutely.
It sounds like that's where you're headed.
Yeah, totally. And I think that that's a fantastic and a stellar example, right? Grameen is a perfect example of having the white space that was free of incumbents. And by incumbents, I don't just mean like you said, an existing giant telco, an existing kind of financial institution, but also kind of a state that had stepped in and said, you know, here's the playing field by which you have to operate. And part of the problem in the states isn't just that we have incumbent corporations who are now kind of, you know, overweening oligopolies within most industries. It's also that we have a set of regulations that structurally tilt the playing field away from entrepreneurs and away from business, as I've discussed.
So
one of the things that I think is really vital to keep in mind, and so let's extend your Grameen example for a second. Right? In Betterness, I argue that one of the things that's going to shape the identity of nations going forward is to update their sets of national accounts, to build new institutions for national accounts, to build a national balance sheet to complement this thing called GDP. And I think just as it was possible for Iqbal to create Grameen in Bangladesh, it's more likely to me that a startup nation is going to create the economic institutions of the 21st century than maybe one of the advanced economies.
No, I think that's right. I think this is a great conversation. Actually, I'm going to just tweet this post that I just wrote, but I think it's really synchronous with all kinds of stuff that you've written, and I encourage you to tweet sort of similar examples out to Ashoka U online later on. But you know, in my version of it was, if you're not pissing somebody off, you're not innovating. I'm stuck on that because, you know, there are people saying, well, you know, if you're, you know, there's a lot of ways. In other words, you know, just being abrasive and so forth isn't the nature of innovation. Yeah. I totally agree with that. But I think that whether, you know, whether it's in Pakistan or the United States, you know, the understanding who the incumbent interests that will be opposed to what you're doing, understanding what you're disrupting, when you're disrupting, I think is an important part of innovation. You know, I don't want to miss the chance to have a particular, you know, other kind of discussion here, you know, which is that, you know, I've been amused since we know how synchronous, you know, kind of our views are. And, you know, but I've been interested occasionally, you know, when my book, A Coming Prosperity, came out, and, you know, you were very kind to sort of tweet the link and say, hey, you know, this is something looking at. And I saw folks on your Twitter feed saying, but Umair, you know, this guy's about to, you know, the positive vision of the future, and you're always so bleak, you know. How can you like this if you're so bleak, right? And so I mean, I wanted to ask you, where does this all come together? How can you get excited about, you know, a book that's titled The Coming Prosperity, you know, regardless of whether I wrote it or not, but, you know, given the message that's in the book, and, you know, given what you said, all the obstacles, this institutional vacuum in much of the world, the institutional paralysis that exists in the rich world, you know, how is any of that synchronous with a message of opportunity in the 21st century?
Okay, so let's go back a couple of steps. You know, one of the things that people often see in my stream, in my Twitter stream especially, is a lot of kind of, you know, I would say blunt talk, okay, about the state of institutions and enterprise and all of this kind of stuff. And I think on some level we're used to hearing things very sugar-coated. Right, we're used to kind of CNN anchors smiling at us and telling us everything is going to be okay. I think it's up to us to make everything better. And I think that's where our opportunity is. Now, let me go back to something you said a few minutes ago, which is that if you're not pissing someone off, you're not innovating. I think there's a really deep truth there. And I think the truth is that an innovation, you know, innovation is a word that's become cheap in these days. And it refers to, you know, a slightly smellier deodorant or something. It's not an innovation, right?
Right.
And innovation is something that actually makes people, in some meaningful sense, in some human sense, better off. And if you can do that, odds are that, just as you said, you are going to piss off an entitled, privileged incumbent somewhere. And so I think that people, when they look at my stream, focus on kind of, you know, a lot of the frustration that I express. But the frustration is not that we are inevitably sliding downhill. The frustration is more that there are so many opportunities to unseat incumbents of all stripes, corporations, governments, all kinds. Across the globe,
right? Exactly. It's just red meat day for carnivorous entrepreneurs on this call and in this course. I mean, there's just nothing but red meat if you're an animal that wants to destroy dead institutions. I mean, you know, for the vegetarians out there, that may not be an appealing analogy, but let's call it, you know, open playing field, you know, whatever kind of space. And I think, you know, I think we can each relate to that in our experience as, you know, alleged consumers of the so-called services that we receive from incumbent institutions, whether they, and I'm here at, you know, I'm here at an educational institution. I think, you know, I hope we do a decent job and not as bad as some of the financial institutions have done to consumers. But still, there's so much scope for improvement in energy, health, and this is in the United States, but, you know, we can look anywhere else in the world, so...
Absolutely.
Is that what you mean, like we have to do it? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. It is incumbent upon us to do it. You know, the act of enterprise is really kind of a creative act. It's bringing something new into the world. And the act of innovation is unseating an incumbent, making the world a better place. It's up to us to put these two things together and really... really begin to give the status quo a bit of a beating, a bit of a challenge, a bit of a rebellion. And and so on my Twitter stream, so let's talk about prosperity and opportunity for a second. You know, one of the things I say on my Twitter stream to people is, listen, enjoy your mixed future. Now, what do I mean by that? I don't mean, hey, globe, enjoy your mixed future. Because one thing is certain. The vast majority of humanity over the last 20 years has gotten a lot richer than they were before. But what I do mean by that is that the 200,000 people that follow me on Twitter, who presumably mostly are wealthy enough to be in the global top 1%, unless they rise to the opportunity in the way that the developing world has over the last 20 years, they are not going to keep pace. Because the way that the developing world has risen up and rebelled against our entitlements and privileges in the rich world has been nothing short of startling. Like the enterprise that they have put forth is fantastic and fascinating. And it is the kind of prime mover of economic growth across the world at this stage. And so I think to kind of square the circle, I think the opportunities are very much there for the taking for us. But I do think we have to be much, much more aggressive in actively pursuing them. You know, one of my favorite examples is finance. So we know now in the rich world for the last, I would say, decade, that we have a broken financial industry, set of institutions. And yet, we see very, very little kind of pursuit of reinventing them.
Right.
And so I think it's up to us to seize the opportunities that are in front of us. Because the rest of the world definitely isn't going to wait around. Right? If I can go back to Pakistan and see Pakistan becoming a hotbed of social enterprise and moving ahead to kind of seize this institutional vacuum and fill it, while we in the rich world are kind of scared to push against these institutional rigidities to kind of break the straitjacket of this paralysis, then I think the future is very clear, right? If that makes sense.
So we've got a picture where we know that the conventional accounting is focused on flows. It doesn't look at stocks. It doesn't look at the way in which certain categories of ventures that may look very successful in terms of generating a lot of flows of resources actually are depleting stocks. And other ventures that may look meager in terms of flows are actually phenomenal in terms of stocks. And actually, I didn't get to the punchline of Arvind Eye Hospitals, but it's going to be in the reading coming up. And, you know, this is a gentleman who is as his retirement project started a hospital that cured 3 million people of blindness over the period of 30 years. And as far as, you know, where that would have IPO'd or what that venture takes in is compared with, you know, kind of a standard Fuddruckers in, you know, in suburban New Jersey on a weekend night, may not be particularly impressive. But the notion of actually curing 3 million people of blindness is, I think, anybody, you know, something that any human being can relate to. So we've got all that on the table. And that's a sense of how we think about our own success. We've got this sort of set of institutional challenges that are different in different parts of the world, but kind of similar in the sense that incumbent power is going to oppose innovation, that if we don't understand the way in which incumbent power is going to resist innovation, then we're probably not innovating because we don't really understand how we're pushing back against the structures that are. That seems to be part of the story. And then you've got this notion of putting in the global context. I want to, you know, we've got 4 minutes left. And since we have 4 minutes left, I want to ask you about timing. When is the right time, either our historical time culturally or in somebody's life, to do any of the things you're talking about? When is the right time? When should we do this thing?
Listen, the you know, one thing I say on Twitter, maybe I don't say it enough these days, but I say, you know, the time is now, and it always has. And the story of kind of human progress is the story of people seizing the mantle and kind of, you know, running off with it in places that were fundamentally unexpected. And I think one of the challenges that we have is kind of not timing, but the scale of our ambitions. You know, I think in a sense where timing and ambition collide these days is that living through an era of institutional breakdown, our own ambitions sometimes wither. And all we see in front of us is the ability to kind of take baby steps into a future that we don't really want. But the way to combat a set of failing institutions is not to kind of take baby steps into decay. It's to dream much, much bigger and say, listen, guys, I have a fundamentally disruptive and huge idea. And I'm not going to take no for an answer. I'm going to set this thing up. I'm going to build it. And this is the way it's going to be. And so by the scale of our ambitions, what do I mean? I mean, when I go, so I split my time between London and New York. When I go back to New York, I see a lot of young people in cafes working on apps that are presumably designed to fit into this kind of Zynga Facebook economy. Their goal is to kind of sell more ads. Now, that's an ambition. It's one ambition. It's not a particularly noble ambition, and it's not a particularly big ambition. A big ambition would be to say, listen, guys, I know that the way the global financial system operates is broken. And I'm going to set up a 21st century bank, and here's my architecture, here are the stocks and the flows and the whatnot and the technical details. But the ambition that I have is to do something that fundamentally makes the world a better place. It goes back to that idea of social value and doesn't just incrementally add an other few pennies to it, but discontinuously, disruptively, adds, you know, whole new orders of magnitudes of zeros to the end of it.
So we're not in danger of being either too impatient or thinking too big.
Quite the opposite.
Go ahead. I got a great question that came in online that I want to make sure we get in here before we close. But go ahead.
I think it's quite the opposite. You know, I talk to tons of people about tons of ideas. And one of the things I'm surprised by is that the longer this crisis rolls on, the smaller the ideas seem to get. I see bigger ideas today coming from places like, coming from kids, young people, in China, India, Brazil, Pakistan, than I do in London, New York, San Francisco, and Boston. You know, and that, to me, is, you know, it says a great deal about the global story we've been discussing, but it also says something about timing and ambition.
Yeah. Now, Sue James tweeted something that I think was really great, and basically she's saying, is any and all rebellion good? A stagnant pond needs scum, right? But a flash flood drowns life. So are we like no holds barred, you know, just take everything down? Is that the message right here?
No, not at all. So we have kind of multiple strains of I would say countercultural thinking going on at the moment, right? And one of those strains says the only thing left for us to do is embrace the collapse of civilization as we know it, to kind of overstate the case, okay? I'm trying to be a little bit ironic, but you get the idea. I don't think that we should embrace the collapse of civilization. I think what we should be doing is building fundamentally more productive and humane institutions. And I think that when we think about the act of rebellion, there are many kinds of rebellion, right? It's not just about destructive and constructive rebellion. There's also rebellion against the self and rebellion against society in many other ways to define it. The way that I would put it to you is the challenge that I see for today's entrepreneurs is to be builders in an authentic sense, not builders of apps, not builders of products, not builders of services, builders of institutions. Creators of tomorrow's great ecosystems of real human and social value. Now, that to me is a noble, worthy, and big ambition worth pursuing. It is also a rebellion against the status quo that programs you to merely be a consumer of the lowest common denominator. But it's a constructive rebellion. It's a human rebellion. It's a rebellion not just against, but a rebellion towards.
Beautiful, beautiful. You know, Amir, we're gonna close out the call in 8 minutes, but I'm hoping you could stay on because I was gonna spend the last little bit on some you know, kind of logistical points, but you know, we're gonna cover some of that in an email. You know, I'm already seeing a lot of you know, what we were gonna talk about happening tonight. You know, I wanna encourage anybody who's listening online, who's not on Twitter, you know, to join Twitter. And basically, you know, just to get comfortable typing in the characters, you know, number sign, Ashoka U online, just that, right? You type that in, and anything else you type will come up in a place where we can all see it, we can all follow the discussion. There's a great flow there. So Twitter's going to be kind of our organizing place. It's going to be our meeting place. We're going to have a collaborative workspace. You're going to get an invitation to that. And that's a space that's actually started by a student entrepreneur. You know, he has a company that's really gotten some great traction. And so we're going to be using that as our kind of collaborative workspace. And again, very low bandwidth. It's essentially just sort of blog posts and responding to blog posts. That's kind of the mode. We have it in its own protected space because you guys are working on entrepreneurial initiatives, and we don't want to have that all in the, you know, sort of in a public view, because some of these things are things you're going to want to keep to yourself, keep to a closed community. So, you know, we're 700 plus people, but we're in a trusted community, sharing ideas, critiquing ideas with each other in this collaborative workspace that you're going to be invited to momentarily. But you know, when you sort of talked about you know, having a vision of disruption, I wanted to kind of, you know, make this a little bit personal in terms of why we're doing this. Why are we doing this course? And you know, and why do it, you know, when we don't know what we're doing, right? So it's kind of obvious. Like, we started out tonight, you know, it was messy, right? And you know, we always want to be better rather than worse organized. But and this is going to sound like a kind of a making excuses thing, but I think if you kind of bear with me, you'll see the point. If you read another book that we've assigned, Lean Startup, right? Why do we assign that? The core concept in the Lean Startup methodology is something called a minimal viable product, that you are ready to go once you have the least capital intensive, least effort intensive thing that can basically barely work, right? And then you get feedback. And what we're doing right now on Twitter is we're getting feedback from you, and we want to continue to get feedback because this isn't a product we're selling. It's not even a question that we're not charging for the course. We're charging in your time. This is extremely costly for everybody who's a part of this. We realize it's extremely costly, and we take very seriously both the folks who are tuition paying here in Arlington, who are part of a degree program working towards, you know, a very specific path of advancement, but you know, everyone else who's joined online, you're investing your time. You are trying to, you know, build. And I see people up at 4 o'clock in the morning, up at, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning to join this conversation. And that puts a lot of pressure on us to really deliver. So we take that very, very seriously. But at the same time, what we're trying to do is exactly what we're hoping you'll do. I mean, we are in exactly the same boat. There are no experts here. There is nobody in charge. You know, there's nobody running this show. It's you guys and us, and we're doing exactly the same thing. We're trying to find a path towards creating value for as many people as we can, at as low cost as we can, in a manner that challenges incumbent modes of doing business and that has the potential to really generate societal disruption on a significant scale and bring about the sort of changes that Umair is talking about. I mean, Umair is shining a light to the underbelly of all the crap that we're all seeing, and he's doing it in a kind of a way. I mean, this is why he's the first guy on my call. This is why, you know, I'm following him, you know, on my Twitter feed. You know, he's one of the only things I follow, you know, just to see how people comment on what he's saying. And the reason I resonate so much with what Umair is talking about is because it's about impatience, and it's about a sense of, hey, you know, come on, we got to take ownership of this thing. We got to move. So in our own, you know, puny way, this is what we're trying to do with this course. It is, you know, a hack-together thing, but we want to make it happen, and we want to see Ashoka U Online grow so that we have, you know, 10,000 people enrolled in 15 different courses next summer, and we want to see this kind of disruption happen in education, you know, on a large scale. And that's just one industry, and there's so much to do. You know, just wanted to put out all that on the table, kind of, you know, direct you to Lean Startup, You know, the other thing, just to explain, you know, we're making you buy books. For some of you, that's a big hassle. And if you're, if it's an insurmountable obstacle, get in touch with us, send us an email saying, I'm not able to get the readings. We want to solve that for you. But, you know, we do it for a reason, because each of these books has a specific message. I mean, obviously mine, I spent a lot of time on that, and I put a lot of myself into it. So, you know, I'm imposing that on all you guys. I just explained Lean Startup. And the other one, you know, that's really about you know, serendipity and trying to situate yourself to make change, and that's the book by John Seely Brown and John Hagel. And what you're doing by taking this course is you're doing, again, exactly what that book is about. You're placing yourself in an environment to connect with people, and then the next step is you've got to look for the moment, right? We're not going to tell you when the moment is. You're going to know when the moment is, when you've made a connection with somebody, or you've had an idea, or something unexpected happened with you, to you, with other people. That's when this course starts to create value. So you, I asked everybody else, what's success, you know, in this course? We've been watching you answer. Your answers have been great. The one answer I would add is, when at the end of all this time something unexpected happens, something deeply unexpected happens that you did not envision when you started, that's going to be your moment. And when you see that moment happen, latch onto it, because all the time you've invested in being part of that, it was to bring that about. So anyway, that's basically trying to situate the course, the conversation we've had with Umair. Umair, before we close, we've got like 60 seconds left. You've been totally awesome to come on. Thanks for, you know, kind of bearing with the little startup stuff at the beginning. And your comments have been great. Any final thoughts you want to share with this group?
Yeah, listen, you know, how can I put this in a concise way? You know, thanks for having me. It's been wonderful. I see the tweets. I'm so glad to see so many of you participating and taking something away from this. I think that what you just said about, you know, this is a platform to do the stuff that we're talking about is kind of where it's at. You know, we have so many tools at our fingertips to make this stuff happen right now. I think sometimes we don't appreciate how incredibly privileged we are. You know, we're the most privileged people in history. And maybe it's time to kind of bear the mantle of responsibility and step up to the plate and create the future that we really want. So you know, thanks for having me. It was fantastic. I really enjoyed it.
All right, we're wrapping up. That's it. You've had the final word, Umair. Thanks, everybody who's dialed in. You know, I know it's a strain, particularly all of you in different parts of the world, but thanks. We'll do this again next week. We got our system down. I think we're going to be ready to roll right at 7:30 on Wednesday. On Wednesday is our next session. Wednesday, 7:30, we'll see you then. Okay, tuning out. Thanks.